That's Segundo here, and I'd just like to say that I choose not to discuss my own relationship with music. Like most, if not all, relationships, my connection with music yielded rotten fruit. So much so that I am often forced to listen to lengthy Gregorian chants to ensure that all the mad demons fly out of my posterior and start nestling in random perches in my room at the Motel 6. I often have to shake the evil beasts away from the empty bottles. After all, there might be a few dregs for me to down. I suspect this is why the maids choose not to clean my room or provide room service, much less one of those special services you can find in other motels. Not this one. Then again, if one cannot order a bottle of tequila on credit in this hellhole, what indeed is the point of living? Perhaps I should scream like a deranged lunatic and give them some music in return. Although our young loving correspondent learned from Dr. Oliver Sacks that silence is sometimes the best weapon.
Okay, so I'm here with Dr. Oliver Sacks, who was most recently the author of Musicophilia. How are you doing, Doctor?
Okay.
Full
of music.
Few of music. Is it musicophilia? Or I mean, it's sort of...
Musicophilia.
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 Yeah. I want to sort of say that with some sort of like, you know... Exotic zest.
Yeah, but you say it as you want. You won't find it in the dictionary, although you will find musicomania and musicophobia.
Gotcha. Well, first off, I wanted to sort of start with a kind of basic question. You point out that even patients with dementia, Tourette's and Williams syndrome can experience the same emotional response that other people do through music, and that music can serve as a memory retrieval cue. You write of dementia patients, once one has seen such responses, one knows that there is still a self to be called upon, even if music, and only music, can do the calling. But if the response we're talking about here is cortical or subcortical, I'm wondering, why is this the actual medium that gets through the auditory cortex more than anything else?
By the way, are we recording or not? Oh. I mean, we're recording, but this is not live, no.
No, it's not live.
I wonder whether, since this comes up, whether I could actually give you a tiny bit of audio, which happens to be of Woody singing.
Sure.
Let me see if I can find this. You're going to hear a man who's had Alzheimer's for 15 years, is devastated neurologically, psychologically, doesn't know where he is, who he is, how to dress, but...
Shooby-dooing, making the scene. Shooby-dooing, know what I mean. Everything is truly serene when I'm around you. Shooby-dooing.
But he is still able to sing professionally with his a cappella group. And you see, he has a lovely voice, and the singing has all the humor and the sensitivity. It's as good as he ever did. And when he sings, he seems normal, and he feels normal. He has his identity. The only identity he has is given to him here in the act of singing with music.
That's truly astonishing. He sounds extremely suave there, I have to say. But I'm just wondering, why is it that music is the specific thing that actually causes the auditory cortex to respond? More than anything else. I mean, why not sort of specific conversation? Or maybe we can even talk about the terms of what we mean by music when this causes Woody here, for example, to respond.
Yeah. Music is especially potent. I think the human brain is very much geared and tuned to the perception of music, the imagination of music, the memory of music, and this tends to persist when almost everything else has been wiped out. So you can have profoundly demented people like Woody here, who are still able to sing beautifully. If you asked him if he knew this particular song, he might not recognize the title or the question or be able to answer. He's hardly capable of conversation in the ordinary sense. But the performance and the memory of performance and how to perform, this sort of memory, although it needs the whole brain to bring it in, it then gets put away in what I like to think of as the treasure house of the subcortex, the lower parts of the brain, basal ganglia, cerebellum, and then it is there forever, even if one has a sort of terrible stroke or dementia. And then what comes out isn't mechanical, it is sort of full of his own sensitivity and so forth. This can happen with other things. I had a cousin who was a Shakespearean actress who also got severe Alzheimer's and lost all memory of her life and really who she was. But if you gave her any first line from Shakespeare, or for that matter any sonnet of Shakespeare's, she would recite beautifully and she would feel herself. And there again, the recitation as part of a procedure, part of a performance.
Yeah. Does it have to be sonorous notes or some kind of sing-song quality, or is it mainly rhythm that actually is the sort of main galvanizing point?
Streams of sound, whether they're language or music, are sort of full of tonality and pitch alterations. They have their own melody, their own as well as emphasis and beats, but music is especially potent and sometimes overpotent, so that, you know, a lot of us can be assaulted by musical memories, pieces which keep playing themselves in the mind.
Yeah.
It's unusual to have words which keep repeating themselves in the same way. I mean, music is more potent than any other stimulus, I think, in getting the mind going.
Speaking of potent music, you actually make reference to earworms, which was a term that was coined by University of Cincinnati marketing professor James Kolaris, or as you actually like to refer to it, as brainworms. I think you're trying to sort of, I guess, take the term and kind of make it a little bit more specific. But there is certainly a danger in getting a song stuck in one's head. But I actually wanted to know, speaking of this notion of being bombarded by music, is it instead, not just in terms of how people are sort of, you know, the people you depict in this book are, in many cases, extremely sensitive to the music. But I'm wondering if this might kind of cause additional neurological problems among the populace, given our current sort of environment of being sort of suffused almost inexorably with endless songs, endless catchy tunes. I mean, you suggest also that music may be nothing more than advertisements for toothpaste. What of this?
Given the fact that we are all, I think even relatively unmusical people, are prone to involuntary, almost automatic repetition of tunes they hear and jingles, the fact that everything is so ubiquitous now, I mean, I've just been in the gym and the swimming pool. I didn't ask for music there. I want to say, who ordered it? You know, and can you turn it off? And they feel it's part of their creativity, it's part of the service they provide. But public places are full of music. 90% of the people in New York seem to be wearing wearing iPods and sort of having their own music. And I think there may be some overloading here. It's certainly a cause of deafness, because the volume can be so loud, and I think the brain may need more of a rest. I mean, I have a radio here in the office, but I can turn it off and I can listen to what I want.
Given the sort of phenomenon, I mean, essentially the iPod is kind of the next version of the Walkman, essentially. I mean, why do you think there's a neurological reason for why people feel compelled to, I guess, have a constant soundtrack going to their lives, or?
Music is important for people, often in all sorts of ways. It can animate them, it can calm them, it can console them, it can fortify them, and it's tremendously powerful in good ways sometimes for patients. People with Parkinson's disease, for example, who may be stuck, who have no sense of, cannot generate a sense of rhythm or timing, who can't utter a syllable or take a step, but they may be able to dance and sing fluently with music. Music gives them the flow, the rhythm, the timing which they can't generate. But what concerns me is people having music on very loudly in order to exclude the external world.
Yeah, Yeah.
In fact, I have a rather bitter feeling about this because I'm fond of cycling, and every morning I go for a bike ride, I have a very loud hooter. Nonetheless, someone with earphones just like yours stepped in front of me, didn't hear my hooter, and I had to brake and I went over the handlebars.
Oh, wow.
And I feel a lot of people are cut off from their environment now. And in a dangerous way. They walk in front of traffic, they walk in front of bikes, they don't talk to people, they don't know where they are. And I love music as a supplement to life, but not as a substitute for life.
Gotcha. I actually wanted to ask you how a musical hallucination differs from a brainworm. You suggest that there are some similarities in this book, but that the hallucination involves something that extends from the realm of actual heard music, meaning music in one's head. Are brainworms in many cases the first step towards a slide into these kinds of hallucinations?
No, not in the least. Okay. And there's a world of difference between any form of imagery, however relentless and automatic and intrusive, and a real hallucination. If you see someone having a hallucination, suddenly their expression changes, they look around, they're startled. What's that? Yeah, you hear that? There is a behavior which is absolutely characteristic of someone hallucinating because the experience is indistinguishable from perception. And they will first look around for someone in the next room, a radio, a band outside, and only when they can't find an external source, then they are driven to the notion, which can be rather frightening, that some part of themselves and some part of their brain has gone on automatic, is out of control. Typically, people use rather mechanical terms. I mean, now they say they have an iPod in their head. And in the old days, they would say, they felt a record was being played,
or
a jukebox. One man in the 1890s said he thought he had a music box in his head. The technology gets into the language. But here the hallucinations are indistinguishable from perception. And they can be physically very loud, like 100 decibels, so loud as to drown out the world, like an iPod, whereas imagery doesn't have any loudness. Imagery doesn't compete with perception in the way which hallucination does. Typically, musical perceptions tend to be of music heard early in life, often popular songs or in a religious generation, hymns, which play repeatedly, sometimes fragments playing again and again. People can't stop it, although sometimes they may be able to switch, as it were, from one track to another. I had one correspondent who wrote to me about his intracranial jukebox, as he called it, and he could switch from one to the other if there was some similarity of rhythm or melodic contour or theme, but he couldn't stop it. When this happens to people, they can be very frightened. You're hearing things? Are they going crazy? Is their brain going? And probably 9 people out of 10 with musical hallucinations keep it to themselves. And if they do mention it to a doctor, they're liable to be misdiagnosed. And it's, I think, very important, to find out the sort of hallucinations people are getting. Musical hallucinations are completely unlike voices. Psychotic voices are aggressive, argumentative, persecuting, humiliating. They're addressed to one. They seem to come from some sort of agency. None of this is the case with a musical hallucination, which is sort of morally neutral, may not even seem to have anything to do with one. And so one has to reassure people that they're not going nuts. And musical hallucinations are particularly common in people whose hearing is fairly impaired, especially older people whose hearing is impaired. I'm an older person whose hearing is impaired, but I don't know whether I would be a candidate or not. Gotcha. I'm interested in them, but I would actually prefer to do without them. But if they persist, one can learn to live with them, and some people become rather fond of them.
Speaking of hallucinations, you also write of musical dreams, pointing to how vivid and clear hallucinations are often triggered in these hypnagogic or Pompic, thank you. I misspelled it. I'm very sorry. Are musical enthusiasts or people who are musically inclined more likely to have these particular dreams or hallucinations? Or maybe you can talk about the difference between the hallucinations and the dreams.
Between?
The hallucinations and the dreams.
Well, we all dream. I don't know where only a few of us hallucinate. People have argued as to whether a dream itself is a hallucination or whether, in fact, it's a form of imagery or imagination which seems so compelling because the world is shut out. One is immersed completely in a dream. Sometimes more than one is in a hallucination. I mean, you can be yourself and say, but I hear that funny music. Whereas when you're in a dream, you can't say, I am dreaming, unless you have a so-called lucid dream, people who are musical tend to dream of music more often. One also has this funny state between sleep and wake, I think, when one can have sort of cinematic hallucinations and musical hallucinations and these hypnagogic, hypnopompic states.
The brain perhaps is more vulnerable during these particular states.
I really only had one such hallucination myself. It was many years ago when I was in hospital for some leg surgery. The room had scaffolding outside and there was no radio reception, and a friend brought me in a tape recorder with one tape, which was Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto, and I played the cassette again and again and again and again, and then one morning I was woken by hearing it, and I thought, I guess the nurse came in, decided to switch on the tape recorder to wake me up, and I listened with pleasure, gradually surfacing, and finally I stretched out a sleepy arm to turn it off, and it wasn't on. But in the act of turning it off, it turned the thing off. But there, I think that was a very unusual situation where I'd been sort of super saturated with this, and I was also half asleep.
But it's also, we're talking about a pattern. Essentially, the Mendelssohn is a pattern that you hear over and over and over. Is this the kind of thing that is going to latch upon your brain so that it's more likely to come out as you're waking up and grabbing...
We are pattern-seeking, pattern-making creatures. I mean, the brain is. I mean, all nervous systems are. But there's something very... seductive and powerful about musical patterns. The brain seems to latch onto musical patterns, but it also reacts very strongly emotionally. Musical patterns are unbelievably complex. They're patterns in time, they're tonal patterns and melodic patterns and so much.
I had a rather specific question about the blindness chapter. You write of the relationship between blindness and music. You point to Adam Oakleford's investigation into septo-optic dysplasia in children and how the degree of blindness played more of a key role in stimulating the musical abilities of these blind children than SOD did. So I have to ask, how then does early music training help a partially blind SOD child in comparison to a more totally blind SOD child? I mean, why measure SOD at all within this actual equation? I just was curious about this.
It so happened that Oakleford in England was concerned with a particular population. Though, as he said, whether it's this particular disorder or something else, what matters is the degree of blindness. He came up with some very astonishing findings, which others have confirmed, that something like 40 or 50% of children born blind have absolute pitch. Absolute pitch is only about 1 in 10,000 in the general population, but it's as if blind people need every possible auditory help to create an auditory world, and they will hold on to absolute pitch. There's some suggestion that absolute pitch is universal in the first year of life, but then gets dropped or pruned out in the majority of people. If one is born blind or is partially blind, then a great deal of the brain, which would normally be used for vision, can be recruited for other purposes, for hearing, for language, for memory, for smell, for taste, for whatever. And so, and in general, sort of, people who are blind tend to be strongly attracted to an auditory and especially a musical world, and to be extremely sensitive to musical training. And of course, there are a large number of famous blind musicians and sure. and jazz musicians, some of whom sort of use the word blind as a sort of honorific.
Sure, I understand that, but I'm just curious as to how SOD ties into this blindness, or is this kind of...
SOD, septo-optic dysplasia, is simply one condition which can produce blindness.
Ah, okay.
It's of no specific importance in itself.
Okay, I gotcha. That's just what I wanted to clarify. There's a lengthy section in this book devoted to the extraordinary case of Clive Wearing, who was a musicologist who suffered severe amnesia and yet managed to retain his musical abilities despite not really having a memory of passing events. I'm wondering, does the brain respond to a set of innate musical rules? You point out that anticipation is not possible with music from a very different culture or tradition, which would kind of differ a little bit if we were to compare this with, say, Chomsky's innate theory of language. I'm wondering, does Clive's ability to find a musical continuum come from a comparable innate theory of music?
First of all, to go over Clive, this was a very gifted musician, musicologist, who had a devastating encephalitis in 1985, which wiped out his memory. His memory for events so severely that he really can't remember anything for more than a few seconds. There was also a retrograde deletion, so that the events of his past life are mostly unavailable for him. So this is a profoundly disabled man in this sense. But then it was discovered almost by accident that his ability to sing and to perform music and even to conduct a choir with great sensitivity and sort of looking around and getting everyone's expression was still there. As with Woody, whom we did earlier. Basically, I think with Clive, this is Clive's procedural memory. Again, the memory of performance and how to perform. Not only how to perform musically, but how to dress, how to converse wittily. I mean, so much of the human repertoire consists of these procedures which will resist amnesia and resist dementia. Now, Clive as a musical person is... I mean, music, as you say, like language, has its own rules of one sort and another, some of which seem to be universal and biological, and some of which seem to be culturally determined. This is why we can often anticipate how a piece of music will go, even if we don't know it. No doubt this is very strong in Clive, but basically with Clive, I think it's his memory, his procedural memory, which was so important.
So it's really, what's the difference between, for example, this innate idea of music and the kind of cognition in Clive's head?
Say that again?
I'm sorry, the difference between the innate rules of music versus the cognitive processes that cause him to sing and perform quite well. What causes him to actually perform as well as he does?
It is memory. It's procedural memory, the memory of how to do things. I don't know that one needs to bring Chomsky into this.
You mentioned anticipation is not possible with music from a very different culture or tradition, so I didn't know if you were making a comparison to Chomsky with this kind of proviso of...
I think this Chomsky thing is a red herring, and I don't know how to answer it properly.
Okay, no problem. We'll move on.
So let's. And I think the business of Chomsky and implicit rules is doesn't have anything obvious to do with Clive's memory.
Okay.
And otherwise we will get into a knot from which we cannot extricate ourselves.
Okay, no problem. Well, I wanted to actually ask you about, we have to talk about amusia. And
yes.
If amusia prevents a person from understanding the precise notes or the pitch of a particular piece, why then does an amusia patient's brain respond to rhythm so effectively? You bring up Merlin Donald's book, Origins of the Modern Mind, pointing to his conclusion that rhythm is a integrative mimetic skill. I'm wondering, though, are there certain types of amusia in which notes and pitch might be reintroduced in an integrative mimetic capacity? Or?
There are a lot of people who have a slightly tin ear, they may love music, they may love singing, but they tend to sing out of tune and not know it. There are famous examples. There was a famous woman called who was much loved in New York, who fancied herself as an opera diva, and she would sing excruciatingly out of tune, and sort of no one knew it. I give a story in the book of a woman who, from childhood on, didn't know what was meant by music, couldn't distinguish whether one note was higher than another. In the real amusia, people don't know what they're listening to. I met one famous French neurologist, and he told me that if he listened to music, he could either say it was the Marseillaise or it wasn't. I forgot to ask him how he could tell it was the Marseillaise. I think he would probably say because everyone stood up, everyone saluted, because he actually could not recognize any piece of music as such. But people who are amusic in this sense, who can't distinguish tones, and who therefore don't have the basis of a scale or a melody, usually have a reasonable preservation of rhythmic sense. And of course, musical sensitivity is not a single unitary thing. There's sensitivity to tone, to rhythm, to this, to that, to timbre. Much more of the brain is concerned with responding to rhythm than responding to tone. In an evolutionary sense, it is absolutely characteristic of human beings, but not of any other animals. We respond to rhythm in the sense of keeping time. We tap, we hum, we move, and even if we don't make any external movement, the motor parts of our brain respond to rhythm. You don't see this in any non-human animal. One suspects that that music may have evolved in the human being and the human species and nervous system initially in terms of rhythm, and perhaps other things came later. It's very unusual to meet people who don't have a sense of rhythm, and I think rhythm is sort of the primordial basis of music in the way, or one of them.
I'm wondering though if some of the other factors of music that are non-rhythmic can actually possibly be instilled through a kind of rhythmic process.
Interestingly, in some people who have musical hallucinations, they may first be conscious of a rhythm and then their mind starts to apply a tune to it. I think we all do this.
Yeah.
We hear train noises and we start to add to this. One friend of mine thought that the rhythmic noise of the refrigerator was playing Haydn. Haydn or Mozart would gradually get added to the noise of the refrigerator. Another friend of mine who was on board ship and rather becalmed found his mind adding tunes to the rhythmic sounds of the waves and things. So I think we add things to rhythm all the while.
I'll ask you one last question because I know you have a busy schedule. If the right hemisphere is plastic enough to allow for the reallocation of linguistic processing for aphasic patients through melodic intonation therapy, are there disadvantages in tapping a part of the brain that isn't expressly designed for this behavior? And is it possible for non-aphasics to employ parts of the right hemisphere for their own linguistic purposes or uncommon linguistic purposes?
Well, listen, I think one may need to say how extraordinary this whole business is. Although in a four-year-old child, the brain is still very plastic, and if it's necessary to remove a whole hemisphere of the brain, this would sometimes have to be done if there was a tumor or intractable epilepsy, the other hemisphere can take over. But in an adult, things seem to be very specialized. So far as language is concerned, you have a language area, several language areas, in the left hemisphere of the brain, and it would seem that if one had a stroke or a tumor which destroyed them, that was that. And this was very much the received idea until pretty recently. But people who've lost language are able, usually, to sing, and sometimes not simply to sing a tune, but to sing it with the lyrics, which itself can be very, very reassuring to them, because it shows them that language is still there somewhere, even if it's not available in any other way, but it is available embedded in music. Now, with something called melodic intonation therapy, and this is very arduous, this is like at least 100 hours of therapy need to be done, and with well-motivated people, because this is tough going.
Yeah.
But it may be possible with them to somehow retrieve language, which has previously been automatic, and to relearn it using the right hemisphere of the brain. Now, this is staggering. 5 years ago, this would not have been thought possible. This is an amazing example of plasticity in an adult brain. I mean, what further one can say, I don't know. In fact, I'm afraid I've forgotten what your question was.
Well, it's more about, can non-aphasics actually get this sort of sense of being able to tap into the right hemisphere of their brain for these non-linguistic or linguistic purposes? Or is this something that is by no means, as you were sort of suggesting, a foolproof process? It sounds to me like there are some problems with MIT.
Normally the two hemispheres work together, and one only becomes conscious of the particular weaknesses or strengths of one hemisphere of the brain if something happens. One interesting example of this is that sometimes if there is damage to the left hemisphere of the brain, there may be an emergence or heightening of musical talent which has previously been in the right hemisphere of the brain but basically been suppressed. A lot's been written on sort of trying to use the right hemisphere and all that, but I don't know. We usually use both hemispheres together.
Sure, gotcha. Well, I have tons of questions, but thank you very much, Dr. Sachs, for your time.
Okay, well, thank you.
Pleasure talking to you. Thanks.
There's only one song worth singing. They may try and sell you, because it hangs them up. Gonna be